A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
Welcome to another edition of Sheer Intelligence. I'm Robert Sheer, and the intelligence comes from my guests. In this case, it's Colleen Nicole Gross, a professor of African American Studies at Wesleyan University and author of the new book, Hannah Mary Tabbs and the Disembodied Torso. I have to say this ruined my last few days reading this book, not because, I mean, it is brilliantly written and documented to in great detail about a serial killer who happened to be a black woman in the late part of the 19th century, and it's not at all depressing. I would recommend it as an interesting read, but it really takes you through, I think I can use the word sordid here, sordid world, not just in terms of the principal character, but the world that she was forced to live in, basically a white world, a world in the period after the end, official end of slavery, but the continuation of a really oppressive life, basically centered in Philadelphia. And I should say that you wrote a previous book that was very well received on that same period, called Colored Amazons, Crime, Violence, and Black Women in the City of Brotherly Love, 1880 to 1910. So you kind of own this area, and I figure it has something to do with your own education. I teach at the Annenberg School at USC, and I noticed you got your doctorate and everything at the sister school at University of Pennsylvania, right? Not in the Annenberg School, but there. So how did you go from this sort of academic specialty to what is truly a grisly subject of murder and serial killing? And what is the purpose of the book?
The purpose of the book, well, to start me off with a softball, why don't you, Robert? So I'll tell you, you know, this book had its origins in my first book. I was doing research on black women in the criminal justice system in, you know, Philadelphia. This is sort of the birthplace of the penitentiary, in addition to being the birthplace of the nation. And I came across this dusty scrapbook that was maintained by the guards at Eastern State Penitentiary. And they apparently had taken sort of newspaper clippings of their most sort of infamous charges. And I came across this case about a dismembered torso and, you know, all of these crazy antics. And I just could not put it down. So, you know, initially the book just sort of germinated out of my own sort of interest. I was as curious and as titillated, I guess, as the 19th century readers. And I was just struck that there was a black woman at the heart of the story.
No, or maybe you could summarize that story.
So they actually organized it in order of how the story emerged, in spite of the fact that she had already been sort of in prison there. And a torso basically surfaces in this pond, which is just outside of Philadelphia. It's headless and limbless. It's a torso of a man. But the coloring is such that they're not able to discern his race. And this is sort of a huge crisis for the investigators, but also really the country at this point. You know, it's after slavery, it's after Reconstruction. This is this period when we start to hear fears about miscegenation. So, like, you know how there's the documentary coming out, a film, I think, about, like, you know, the Loving case in Virginia, you know, that sort of finally, you know, got rid of the ban on interracial marriage. This is the period where a lot of those bans started, because they were concerned that race mixing would ultimately lead to this sort of infiltration of white society. So when this torso surfaces, there's a lot of anxiety about just who this victim is and how he came to this sort of unfortunate end. And the fact that they thought it was a white man worked in his favor because they, you know, really sort of kind of committed all their efforts to trying to solve the case. One of the things that was sort of harrowing in the course of doing the investigation about the case is that throughout the investigation and the trial, various body parts of other black folks surfaced. And once they decide that it's not a part of this case, it just automatically fades into the background. There's no investigation into what happened to them, how they, you know, met these unfortunate demise.
I do want to say about your book, because I've stressed that it's about murder, it's grisly. It's also about a very strong woman who's an improbable central character to observe. But you do come away kind of respecting her, I think is the right word, or at least acknowledging her independence, her toughness. She's a survivor, you know, along a line back from slavery. And what is, to my mind, the incredible strength of this book, we have this fairy tale that it sort of denies. And the fairy tale is, sure, we had slavery, but that ended and we went on to a nice life. And then why do we still have problems? And what your book does, because it's really great history, the way you've woven the tale of this woman is you give us, you know, all the clippings, all the news reports, the texture of life, not in the Deep South primarily, although people have come from the South, but they're in the city of brotherly love. And as you just mentioned, that's where the penitentiary system started. And it really goes to the basic question, first of all, are black people humans? Because you have a scene in there where somebody just describes, you know, they're like the cattle, they don't have souls. You know, so a denial of the whole black church experience at all, or relation to Christianity. And also, it makes very clear and in detailed way the discrimination of against black people, the isolation and so forth, after the end of slavery and in the North, and the contempt, the alienation and so forth. So it actually takes a murder story and uses it an occasion to acquaint people with history, with what was life like back then. And it's not a pretty tale.
No. And so in some respects, this gets back to your first question from when you asked me kind of what was the point or what did I want to write this book? And it was, you know, it started out with my sort of fascination about this case. But then the more I learned about it, it was this woman who was unlike any other black woman that I had sort of read about in history. And I'm saying this as a historian. I was fascinated and intrigued. And I liked the fact that she was deeply flawed. I mean, I hope that comes across in the book. I mean, I've tried to read her in the context of the period. And you're right, it is ugly, it's sordid, it's violent. You know, she comes into her womanhood during the Civil War, right? This bloody violence that goes on in the country that, you know, black women were particularly vulnerable to rape and brutalization. But even before that, she lived in a town that was notorious for a really brutal sort of slave-owning family. So there was sort of this kind of violence in the society and in the culture already there as this backdrop, so that once you have slavery, you know, abolished, you have black folks trying to sort of actualize their rights and enjoy their freedom. But it's deeply fraught. I mean, the whole country is scarred. There's real trauma. You know, she emerges with this, you know, little baby in tow that is mulatto, and the circumstances of that child's origins are pretty murky. So she is a survivor in many respects. She migrates up north. She kind of marries a fairly good guy and tries to make a go of it. But she's got real problems, right, with anger, with violence. And she uses it to kind of create space for herself in a world where it usually didn't exist for black women.
What I thought the value of the book, aside from that it's a very good read, exciting, and you want to know how it all goes, is it explains the deformity of life in America, that this country, particularly as regards the issue of race and slavery, set out to deliberately deform, deny the humanity of Black people and others, Native Americans, and there's a whole history, but in, particularly around the issue of slavery, which then extends to life in the North in a very basic way. And there's a modern significance to that because it deals with criminality, it deals with law enforcement, it deals with the behavior of authorities. And even though you're talking about distant events, there's an echo in today's policing issues.
Yes.
And when I look through some of your articles, you, of course, write about contemporary policing issues. So I read those and then I went back to your book and I had to remind myself we're talking about, you know, a half century or more, a century distance from those events.
Right. And this is the other piece of the sort of point of it is that I can't tell you how astonished I was to see how closely or how much the events that were taking place with respect to policing and investigations and race, all the issues around brutality and racial profiling, how closely aligned they were to cases and ongoing issues today. It was shocking for me. And in some respects, you know, I'm almost embarrassed to say that because as a historian, part of why I do what I do is because I want history to be a beacon, right, to speak to today. To try, you know, to resurrect these histories so that we can learn from them. So I shouldn't have been as surprised as I was, but I mean, really, it was uncanny in certain respects. But it was also instructive for me because it showed sort of early on how the Black community's sort of isolation from unbiased protection is related to crime in the Black community. So, you know, whenever we have these cases that arise currently around, you know, shootings of unarmed Black folks with, you know, with white police officers, one of the pushbacks right away is, well, why don't they care about sort of, you know, quote unquote, Black on Black crime or crimes that take place in the community? And, you know, my answer to that is always, one, we do, but also that the two issues are actually related. They're both sort of an artifice of Black folks' inability to benefit from unbiased, you know, criminal justice.
Yeah, that's sort of the heart of the whole book, because the police are presumably there to protect people, and you have a lot of detail, actually, how many there were and what their skill set was and limitations and so forth. But the, again, the modern echo is they're alienated from a community. And so either you surround that community and then ignore it and let them kill each other, what have you, and make life miserable for the people who don't want crime and are afraid of it, or you go in and you're very aggressive. And there's a phrase in your book, I don't know if you intended it to have this modern application, called preventive policing. And that's a hot issue now in cities in America. They're very actively using computers, databases, and so forth. It's a project, you know, I don't want to be conspiratorial here, but Palantir is a company founded by the CIA that's very involved with that. It happens here in Los Angeles. It happens in New Orleans, New York, and so forth. And it really has a lot to do with a very sophisticated racial profiling of people and then predicting who's going to be a criminal, and then you go after them and you find evidence of crime. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I was surprised that that shows up in your book, describing again a period of another century.
So there's also in the backdrop this idea that crime or criminality is inherent, right? That you have sort of professional criminals, people who are inherently criminal. And so the police force and the detectives that are emerging are committed to a kind of muscular policing, right? They want to sort of get ahead of it and do this sort of preemptive, preventative kind of surveillance of people who they believe might commit crimes, who have, you know, committed crimes in the past, or who, you know, in some instances, right, they detained Black folks who they didn't believe belonged in certain places or who were carrying goods that they didn't believe they owned. They had police manuals that instructed them to detain folks who looked like they were from outside of the state. So it left Black folks vulnerable, but it also left poor whites vulnerable, and also immigrants. European immigrants were incredibly vulnerable to being detained and harassed, too.
Yeah, let me ask you, I didn't get a sense from the book, was there any effort at all to have a police department that was somewhat more representative of the community? You mentioned when the immigrant populations were becoming more prominent in Philadelphia, there was some pressure on, I guess you wouldn't use the word police reform, but some challenge to the thing. Was there any sense at all about representation, race, gender, what have you?
So there are these moments where you do actually have some black police officers in Philadelphia at this time. There's not a huge amount of work done on them, so it's unclear to me whether they sort of policed all communities or only black areas. I don't have a good sense of what their numbers are. But also with respect to women, so women become involved with policing in a couple of key ways. You start to have middle-class reformers being really concerned about the treatment and particularly the vulnerability of women in these all-male spaces, right? Rape and sexual abuse and sexual harassment during confinement and even in custody was fairly rampant. So they do start to install kind of like, you know, female matrons or police matrons or women who were there basically to receive female prisoners. They also started to work inside the prisons and women's wards.
This is Sheer Intelligence. I'm speaking with author and professor Kali Nicole Gross. We'll be back after a short break.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
We are back with Sheer Intelligence, and my guest is Kali Nicole Gross, author of the book Hannah Mary Tabbs and the Disembodied Torso. And you were saying about the female aspect of this.
Right. So this, that there were women who actually worked in sort of stations and also within the penitentiary on female wards to sort of help protect the women's virtue when they were in custody. This could be an interesting segue into sort of the other kind of lurid aspects of this story, which revolve around kind of Tabbs's sex life. You know, this is sort of the tail end, too, of the Victorian period where, you know, the ideals of chastity and morality and certainly fidelity and marriage were touted by everyone. And you know, African-Americans as well as white people really sort of believed in those values and strove to at least publicly represent them. And for all intents and purposes, Hannah Mary Tabbs did just that. So one of the things that was also sort of a shock about this case is that once they kind of suss out the identity of this victim and they realize he's involved in, you know, this adulterous relationship with this older woman, it really becomes this sensation. And I was pretty surprised myself because as the investigators, you know, hone in on her and another suspect and they, you know, start to suspect that her home serves as the crime scene, when they go and investigate, they actually find the victim's clothes or her lover's clothes are in the home that she also shared with her husband. So initially, I couldn't sort of make heads or tails of it. Like, well, did they work out some sort of arrangement? We find out, right? I came across this pension record from the Civil War that it turned out he actually fought as a part of on the side of the colored troops, clearly. And had been injured. It said that he had been ruptured in the groin. So I sort of basically put together and speculated that he must have had some kind of performance problem and that she and he worked out this arrangement where he kind of knew that she was engaging in these extramarital affairs and you know, seemed to tolerate it.
Quite an effort. But let me talk about this female character you have. She's...
Sure.
Typically would be a male character, except you're following fact rather than fiction. She's strong-willed. She takes a younger lover in this case that seems to suit her needs. She, intimidates people. She's very aggressive. And that's not the image of the black woman coming out of slavery that one had, that one had the view of always being vulnerable and a victim and so forth. She made her own reality in which she takes charge, for better or worse.
She does. I mean, I was fascinated by her. I tried to be sort of objective in writing the book, and I'm sure there are many points where I failed along the way. But, she did a really good job at manipulating people. She knew how to present herself in the white world. She maintained good jobs. She demurred to white authority publicly. By all accounts, she was a very good cook, so she got lucrative positions and never had any trouble. But within the black community, where she knew folks were isolated and couldn't go to the police or, you know, count on protection in the same ways, she did. She relied on intimidation. She threatened people. She brutalized folks in her family, in her neighborhood, in her lover's neighborhood. I mean, she was known as an all-around tough customer, and that gave her a lot of room. I mean, people tended to sort of steer clear and stay out of her way.
The character we're talking about is Hannah Mary Tabbs. The book is Hannah Mary Tabbs and the Disembodied Torso. And as I said at the beginning, it's not, you know, one of the good things about doing these podcasts, I feel compelled to read books, and often they're books that I wouldn't have read. And this is one by the title that I would not have read, although I was familiar with your work as a scholar. And I assumed and was not disappointed that it ends up actually having a great deal of heft, scholarly and historical heft. And actually, the question really is, how typical was this woman to write a book about, or was she just a hook for kind of weaving a whole good, and not only good, brilliant mm-hmm. account of life in that period? Were there other strong women, not just doing illegal things, but were there other, mm-hmm. I mean, where did she come from? Where did this strength, you said
right.
she worked in these white households most often, she deferred. The whole point, really, of the book is she couldn't have gotten away with this if she was inflicting damage on white people. It was all black people. And that's really a big point about the non-policing, in a good sense, of the black community, which many people would argue continues to this day and in terms of real safety. But how typical was she of a kind of emerging female strength?
Right.
You used the word Amazons for your previous book, so maybe you should talk mm-hmm. about that book as well.
Right. So my first book looked at sort of the ways that black women and were sort of caricatured, right, as being criminal, violent, dangerous, fiendish, right? That they were, you know, these Amazons that basically robbed white men of life, liberty, and property. And that character actually came up to sort of camouflage the fact that there were white men who were going after black prostitutes who would use, sort of manipulate the race codes to rob the men. And because it was such a taboo for white men to be cavorting with black women, they tended not to press charges. And even when they did, the judges would usually throw the cases out, assuming that the white men who wanted to sleep with black women got what they deserved. You know, but when newspapers covered those cases, instead of sort of, you know, talking about, you know, these white men going to black women, you know, would-be prostitutes and ending up being the victims of badger games, they sort of stigmatized and maligned the black women as these colored Amazons and just sort of grabbed these men off the street and took money out of their pockets. But anyway, the point about talking about that caricature is that it was sort of a myth, but it haunted all black women who went before the justice system. So what's also ironic about Tabbs's case is that even though she actually, you know, is violent and does a lot of destructive things, she's able to manipulate the white public gaze in such a way so where they actually see her as a woman who has some sort of respectability. They just can't believe that she could have committed the crime. And a part of that has to do with her sort of racial kind of miming. You know, she turns on her Southern accent. She demurs to white authority. She doesn't look them in the eye. You know, she knows how to kind of manipulate and play white people. And with respect to sort of where she comes from, I think that she really is a combination of the sort of mundane and the extraordinary aspects of black womanhood at this time. You know, on the face of it, she was not dissimilar from masses of Black women who migrated north into Philadelphia at this time. Like 90% of working Black women, she worked as a domestic. She was married. She was raising her quote-unquote niece. I mean, on the face of it, she wasn't particularly extraordinary at all. And yet this case revealed this whole other sort of life and world that she had kind of created.
You know, the strength of your book is in its complexity. I mean, these are not stereotypical characters, and people are all written about as complex. Their origins, their makeup, even their pigmentation, varies. I mean, there's no such thing as just black or something. And one distinction that I found very instructive is that the slavery did not stop being a force, that the experience of blacks in America was permanently, at least up to the present, but certainly during the period you described, altered, deformed, whatever the right word is, distorted mm-hmm. by slavery, and it continues. And you've just referenced it now. There's a way of looking at white people. I once did a profile of Willie Brown, who went on to be, you know, one of the top politicians in California and Speaker of the Assembly and Mayor of San Francisco and all that. But he described growing up in Mineola, Texas, and just the nuances. He would watch his father step, you know, down into the street on a narrow sidewalk to let white teenagers pass, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Or, well, and it was the end of the day of segregation, but, you know, you never went to a movie theater that was integrated. And you're dealing, however, with Philadelphia, not Mineola, Texas.
Right.
And yet you're describing, you know, a pretty rigid racial distortion in the experience of a black person growing up in the city of brotherly love.
So one of the things that folks forget is that Philadelphia had at one time, slavery as well. So during the colonial period, Philadelphia, like every other colony, including New York and all these other northern territories, they all had slavery. It isn't until after kind of the founding of the country that they start to shift and gradually abolish slavery. But what happens is that once they abolish slavery, they automatically sort of kind of make the prison system more robust. So it's not a coincidence at the same time that you have in Pennsylvania this sort of 1780 act for the gradual abolition of slavery, that you have on its heels in 1790 the establishment of the nation's first penitentiary. Right. So yeah. Philadelphia has this, you know, this reputation for abolitionism and, you know, Quaker roots and all of these sort of high-minded ideals around sort of liberty and, you know, egalitarianism, but it was marred by the same sort of racism that I think you're pointing out. And I do want to say one thing about when we think about slavery in this country, it definitely has impacted, you know, blackness and the experience of black people. But for me, it's deformed whites in the country as well. And so the behaviors that we see exhibited by the police, the brutality, the, you know, the harassment, even the violence of the justice system, also to me is based on the ways that they too have been marred by this institution.
And I want to get at two themes that are dealt with in the book and again in a complicated way. And one is the whole role of sex. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the subtext of a lot of these issues in the treatment of black women and, you know, as sex objects, their availability, you know, mm-hmm. going back to, okay, so Thomas Jefferson, you know, it's one of the things here was probably one of the better individuals around among our founders, and yet, you know, and maybe he even had a less oppressive relationship, but, you know, it's just, boom, it's there. And I wonder what insight you gained into all of this, and again, its effect on whites as well as blacks.
There's a way in which black women have sort of concealed their sexuality at this time period because they were so vulnerable to rape and sexual assault. And this is in the North and the South, particularly as domestics where they were working in white homes. And they knew there's something happened. No one was going to be punished. They weren't going to get anybody convicted of their rape in the justice system. So they tended to sort of adopt the strategy where they tried to conceal sexuality. Some historians have written about this. Darlene Clark Hine calls it the cultural dissemblance, right? They try to sort of conceal the sexuality as a way to stave off these attacks. So normally we don't have a lot of information about how Black women sort of themselves kind of behind closed doors imagined or understood themselves or their sexuality. So that's part of why I was so intrigued by this case also, that in spite of the respectability politics, in spite of the dangers and the sort of customary efforts that Black women went to conceal, you know, their sexuality and to push back against the idea that they were low common women, that they were all prostitutes and unrapeable, is that you do have this woman sort of taking charge in some way and seeking pleasure nonetheless.
We did run out of time. That's it for Sheer Intelligence. The book is Hannah Mary Tabbs and the Disembodied Torso. And I want to make clear, the subject is depressing. The read is not. It is detailed. It's informative. It moves. Is extremely well written. So I don't want to turn anybody off. If you want to understand this country in the 40 years, 50 years after the Civil War, and understand it in the context of Philadelphia, it's probably the best thing. Well, it's the best thing I know of that you can read. Really important work. Written by Callie Nicole Gross, an academic, a distinguished academic. The producers for Sheer Intelligence are Joshua Sheer and Rebecca Mooney. The engineers at KCRW are Mario Diaz and Kat Yore. Thanks to WNPR in Hartford. See you next time.